give you the patent if you want to play with them. Yeah, well, they've only got about 3 or 4 more years to run now.
When you develop these, in these last two areas where you develop patents that you really didn't pursue, did you have students working, helping in
no.
these areas, or was this
no.
on your own?
No. These are not only gray area patents, because I don't know too much or anything about the fields in which they're involved, but merely have a feeling that if somebody else's processing work, some modifications will improve it. But they also can be called gray matter patents, because they are only developed by the gray matter of the brain rather than by any experimental matter.
Okay.
However, they do, they are very interesting. And then for many years, and dozens and dozens of such patents, I have prosecuted these in the patent office myself. That is, I have made the drawings, I've written the applications, have had no help from anybody except, of course, the typing, in order to, and then argued the case with the patent examiner. That is a very interesting game. The patent examiner, of course, is that division of the government which is the internal negative. No, 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 is their eternal and infernal answer to every positive suggestion that is made. And one has to combat that then with pages and pages of arguments. And it is, though, a very interesting game. It has a greater a feeling of gain, accomplishment, interest, enjoyment than, say, playing chess. And my good wife, Mid, has many times said she was a patent widow, because I would spend weeks in rebutting in the argument of some examiner. Sometimes I lost, of course. However, did on occasion go to the patent court in Washington and argue my own case there. That has been interesting, because I find there's no place for the applicant. They have attorneys' lounge rooms and so forth, and attorneys' entrances and so on, but no place for the applicants, because it's almost unheard of for the applicant to represent himself in these cases.
There was one of the items I wanted to talk about later, but why don't we do that now, since you started your work with patents. How did you develop this ability to... Did you ever have anyone do your patent work, or did you do it from the beginning?
I came into the patent field starting in 1927, when I started to work with Eastman Kodak, who had a wonderful group of patent attorneys and experts. And I worked with them in filing in the first 6 months, or first maybe 9 or 10 months, no less than a dozen patents on the processes which I were developing for azeotropic recovery of acetic acid. Naturally, I learned much from them. After I left Eastman, and while I was still in Rochester, I developed improvement in the processes, and then I looked up a patent attorney in Rochester and worked with him in developing subsequent improvements and processing, which I later then sold back to Eastman. Again, when I came to New York, The first several patents, I worked with a attorney who unfortunately then died, and then his assistant who came up under him, but I found that what I could after three or four of such situations, I found that I would spend less time writing the patent and making the application myself than I would in arguing and demonstrating and educating the patent attorney in the particular field of the interest. So this saved friction in these arguments and discussions and saved time, and so gradually I came into it myself, and ultimately I have for many years now developed my own patents, except foreign ones. One is not able to carry on your work abroad or in Canada by yourself. So I've had to depend on foreign patent agents. More recently, in a legal case in which I was an expert witness, a lawyer for the other side had seen somewhere a citation that I had 150 patents, and he then, in trying to discredit me, came up with the fact, Dr. Othmer, you say you have 150 patents, but the patent office only lists 87. To which I, of course, replied, the 150 is a marginal or a minimal number because it includes foreign patents, and I don't know how many foreign patents were filed by Eastman Kodak, and I don't know how many foreign patents, I've never counted up those that I have myself or have had myself, because of course in so many years most of them have expired.
When you arrived at the patent office to argue your own case, how were you received?
Courteously, of course, with a little surprise by the tribunal of three experts who, not three experts, but three patent examiners, aside from the examiner who was my opponent in this exercise. Again trying to discredit the invention, I of course trying to prove the invention. The disadvantage in such a case is of course the fact that that the three examiners who are represent the judges are associates and pals of the man who's the inventor's opponent, which of course also leads a certain amount of unfairness to the overall position. In one of these cases, my opponent, the examiner, I had absolutely no respect for. He, as either an engineer or a scientist or even a United States employee, he kept me waiting for 20 minutes on one case when I went down to call on him, and then when I did come in and he had nobody in there, or nobody had gone in or out of his office, I looked around and saw about 30 feet of bookshelves. The only thing that were on the bookshelves were half a dozen paperback novels, and one of them with its covers up, since he's laid it down on his desk to see me, was also a paperback novel. So I had no respect for him.
But otherwise, you were reasonably successful in working your own.
Yes, I have been reasonable. As I say, sometimes I've missed. Probably one out of seven or eight I've missed, which is not so bad.
No. Mm. And in those cases where you missed, did you attempt to pursue that, to get it?
Oh, always, yes, always. I fought until I lost. Not always did I feel that I should have won. I mean, I was argued down. In some other cases, I felt it was entirely unjust that I missed. But that, of course, is a normal reaction of any loser.
Well, let me move on to an area where I believe you did do experimental work, you and your students, and that is the affinity series of metals.
Yes.
I'm not clear in my own mind when that work began.
The affinity series of metals was probably about 10 or 15 years ago, was the result of ideas that I developed with a man I was working with in Germany, and the developments which he was making. And oddly enough, that then when I got involved in it, I found that one of my previous students was developing processes for aluminum production in this country. I then worked with him and assigned the patents that I developed with his organization depends on the relative affinity of gaseous metals, rather gaseous chlorides of metals, to react with oxides of metals. And there is an affinity series, very much like the electromotive series for involved in aqueous working. This series, the development of this series, which, as I say, was started by the group in Germany for production of titanium metal. Titanium may be produced and has been produced by the reaction of chlorides of other metals, which will react then with the oxide of the titanium, and will put the titanium in the tickle form, that is TiCl4 form, and that may be that may be converted to the titanium. High pressures may be involved, particularly high temperatures are involved, up to, of course, the limit of various materials of construction. Incidentally, in this it was found that calcium chloride, normally not thought of at all as a useful material for anything except being in an aqueous solution, can be used as a high temperature refractory under some conditions. The technique, the organization of this series of materials, of metals, is a fascinating thing which has not had sufficient recognition.
How many different metals?
I think 8 or 10. We placed an order.
And the major emphasis is the separation of the metal from the.
Well, the reason for this is the separation from the metals by high temperature gaseous reactions. Yes.
And iron also.
Iron chloride. Yes, is one.
Are there any licenses on this process?
No. In a way, I was working both with my friend in Germany and my former student in this country. And while I do have five patents on the going from a bench scale to a pilot plant is so expensive, and it's something just I never spend the time or money or effort to develop. I think it's a great thing, both from the scientific standpoint and from the extractive metallurgical standpoint.
What was the name of your friend in Germany?
His name, Dr. Gerhard Holland, whom is quite an entrepreneur. Dr. Holland had been introduced to me by another of what the Germans have since the war called the Wundernaben, that is, the brilliant boys after the war. I had worked with Hans Zimmer. Did I talk about this before, Hans Zimmer?
No.
Hans Zimmer, who had was interested in acetylene with Dr. Happel and one of his students at that time New York University. Dr. Happel had received his doctor's degree under me in about 1950. There was developed a process for making acetylene. Acetylene is a wonderful tool for organic synthesis, and unfortunately we never got our process off the ground. Acetylene usually uses one less step in making a compound and considerably more efficient than ethylene in any of the many compounds and many ways in which ethylene is made. And Hans Zimmer had read an article which I had written on this in about 1952 or 3, somewhere in there. He called me from Frankfurt, said, "I need a settling process and I'd like to come over and talk to you. I can't be there tomorrow, I'll be there the day after tomorrow. How's that?" I said, "Okay, I'll be here." And so he said, in this chair and told me himself his story. This is a very interesting historical development. Zimmer, whose hobby was high-speed motor cars, had been a test pilot for the Luftwaffe in their testing airplanes during the war. And after the war, he'd decided he was going to go into the chemical industry. He had a background in this. And accumulated a tremendous staff of devoted materials. And he said, now I've been in this about 8 years, and I set out to beat DuPont at Nylon. And I said, well, how have you done? He said, well, every year after this first year, every year after the first year, I doubled my staff and I doubled my gross. Well, I said that would be 2 to the 6th or 7th power. He says, yes, yes, sir, that's it. And he said, now, and he had done that. Develop and build him a pilot plant, which he had shipped over by air for operation. And unfortunately, his boys, when I was over there 2 or 3 times in the early 50s, he had a organization that looked like a Midwestern State University campus. He had his chemistry building, his engineering building, his pilot plant building, and so on, with big green lawns in between. This was on the northeast side of Frankfurt. And an impetuous, imaginative, highly motivated man who the only way he could sleep nights would be to, when he woke up, to read himself to sleep again by reading cookbooks. And from time to time, Mid and I were guests in his home, a very magnificent home in the Taunus Mountains, just outside of Frankfurt. He had introduced me to me to then Dr. Holland, who with whom he was working on various aspects off in the photographic. And Holland did these things as a side because principally he was a banker. His doctor's degree was in business management. His engineer's degree was from Darmstadt, but he was mainly interested in developments in the fields at that time of optics, and then with his outstanding metallurgist, forget the name, I'll put it in. He was developing this process for making titanium. And I worked with him on several years trying to sell it. And we would have sold it either to the Japanese or to somebody in this country. But Holland, who was primarily a banker, could only say to himself, I put $1 million in this development, and therefore somebody that's going to go the next step has got to put $1 million up front and then pay me too. And his philosophy never succeeded in getting it off the ground. I don't know whether he will ever get it off the ground. I think his patent will expire before he does license this process for titanium. But that was how I got into this, and I made some other developments. Found that one of my former students, named Toth, T-O-T-H, had been in the Hungarian uprising in 57, come to this country in 58, and had been in my classes here, but had left and gone down to New Orleans to take a job, and from that he decided to develop an idea that he had had also in making aluminum by a different process than the classic processes which have been in use since the 90s of the last century, almost 100 years. And so when he, when I saw of his work, we got in touch, he with me or I with him, I don't remember, and so I then consulted with him for some years. But he was a better stock manipulator than he was a chemical engineer, and his program has been one continual escalation of stock operations and businesses from India to Brazil, and then back to this country, and companies that are always getting started, and so far never succeeding. That again is a interesting commentary on development in metallurgy.
Let's move on to something else then.
One little thing which will stick back, maybe. I happen to remember something about Badger, who in the late 20s, when he was my professor, the middle 20s, and through the whole of the 20s, he was one of the outstanding chemical engineers. He had always said he didn't have a doctor's degree. He got his master's degree in Minnesota about 1911 in physical chemistry. But he said he learned chemical engineering from manufacturers' catalogs, which was a interesting way of saying how really practical he was, particularly compared with the highly mathematical concepts that are so important in chemical engineering today. One other maybe isolated thing that might go back when we're talking about patents. One company that I worked with in New York was by a very competent and outstanding chemist, Dr. Kokatnur, K-O-K-A-T-N-U-R. Kokatnur was an Indian who'd come to this country in the 20s, and had tremendous number of patents. Well, when I say a tremendous number, probably 20 patents in each of two fields. One, and this was the reason he contacted me and we worked together, was in the so-called azeotropic distillation, because he used azeotropic or steam distillation, as I did, for separating volatile liquid, but more as a means of removing water in synthetic processes. And I had various students on their master's and doctor's degree working with him. Sometimes they were paid by him, sometimes they were not, on processes developing and usually using as the withdrawing agent to steam distill out the water, kerosene. His company was, however, called Autoxygen, Autoxygen, self-oxygen. And that was because the other system that he was had many patents and inventions in was the development of organic oxides, which would be useful per se, and then also in further synthesis of rather complex compounds. Sometime he combined the two of these. I mentioned him as a lead-in to a rather interesting dinner, which he also went to with me in, it must have been the late 50s. I never knew why either of us were invited.